The hour 10:15 have arrived. We will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We will start out. We're going to mix it up here a little bit. And again, this is deadline week. People have places they have to be. So when we have a quorum, I'll move House File 115 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Representative Neuberger, before we start your bill, is there anyone in the audience wish to testify for the bill or with concerns thereof? I know what that means in this committee. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here again to present House File 115. It was part of the Don't Stop Believing tax bill, I believe, of last session, and now it's part of the Rock You Like a Hurricane tax bill for this season. This bill, it's real simple. It allows for first responders, firefighters, ambulance personnel, to simply deduct the cost of their meals, the meal expenses from the taxes. It's one page. If you work less than 21 hours a week, you can do it twice a week for $15 if you work per meal per day, or per day total. And then if you work more than 21 hours, you can do it four times a week. This is a good way to reach out to our first responders and our firefighters and our emergency workers. One of the problems that we have in greater Minnesota is job retention. We can't get people to do this this line of work. It's very difficult to recruit people. This would help folks to retain and recruit. And then also in the busy areas like where I work, where we do 75,000 calls a year, we don't have time to eat. Where Supermom is my second wife. I'm telling you, this is a huge benefit to us. So, members, that's the bill, and I'll stand for questions.
Before we go to questions, does the department wish to testify with comments on this bill? Okay, questions for some Neuberger? Okay, thank you very much. The next bill, and we will be moving these. The next bill is House File 54, Representative Quam. And again, is there anyone wish to testify on behalf of House File 54? Anyone with concerns? Okay, Representative Quam, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I basically, first of all, was there an amendment?
Yeah, Representative Quam, is the A1 amendment yours? Okay, we will act on that when we have a quorum here. So to your bill, sir, as it would be amended.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Basically, this is to allow for the organic and natural growth of broadband across the state. And it's utilizing an approach that was for telephone companies to help make it easier to have a business case and do business in greater Minnesota where there's not the density.
Questions for members? Okay, thank you. We'll set that one aside. We'll now go to House File 1631. And I see no amendments on that one. Representative Quam, to House File. Before we start on 1631, is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of the bill or with concerns? Okay, and then also, does the department wish to make comments on 1631? All right, let's go to your bill. Why don't you start out, Representative Quam, and then introduce your testifier, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this is a topic that we've addressed in the past. You know, medical expenses are high. And for the most part, we don't have a sales tax on, you know, drugs and medical equipment, et cetera. The complexity of the code has shown that there are some missed gaps. And the Department of Revenue was very good at pointing out to us where there was a gap they felt could have a sales tax. We've had the discussion. This is to try and more completely cover the exemption of sales tax on medical equipment. And I do have a testifier.
Okay, I do believe this is Sarah Anderson Day at the Capitol. So please state your name here for the record, please.
My name is Sarah Anderson.
Are you from Atwater?
I am not.
I was in Atwater last night and Grove City. Where's Mr. Cummings? Is he here? Very nice town. Okay.
Yes, it is.
Where are you from?
I'm from Blaine, Minnesota.
Uh-oh. Tigers?
Bengals.
Close.
Very close.
Very close.
Yes.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing House File 1631 this morning. My name is Sarah Anderson. I'm Vice President of Sales and Third-Party Services for Key Medical Supply, a Minnesota-based durable medical equipment company, and I'm also a board member from Minnesota for the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Services. And in that capacity, I'm representing all of my fellow members here today. In the past, our industry has worked with this committee, and we thank you for that work, to restore the historic entity-based exemptions paid for by Medicare, Medicaid, or health plans. We've also worked together in the past, as Representative Plum mentioned, to expand the definition of durable medical equipment, mobility-enhancing equipment, and prosthetics to include repair, replacement parts, accessories, and supplies needed to maintain and ensure their proper function. We are here today for what we hope is a final technical fix to this section of law. House File 1631 would extend the entity-based coverage exemptions that we have worked on in the past to all insurance health plans defined in Statute 62A.11, Subdivision 3 and 7. At present, as Representative Plum mentioned, our state exemptions exempt all sales covered by a public program, either Medicare or Medicaid, and by a public replacement plan, so a Medicaid or a Medicare replacement plan. This takes our existing law and extends it to all health insurance coverage or health insurance entities in Minnesota. It is needed because all of these plans, whether public or private, are governed by the same rules for claims submission. We have the same uncollectibility of sales taxes. I believe there's a handout coming around that we have used in the past, so those of you who are returning members of the committee may have seen it. There is a graph on that that shows the types of denials that we get from commercial health plans. These are, sales tax is not a covered code for these plans. So it is not something that the health plan pays. It becomes something that the business becomes liable for, and as we all know, that is not the definition of sales tax. Sales tax is a consumer tax meant to be borne by the consumer. So the challenges of healthcare administration just make this necessary to complete our past work and have consistency across both public and private plans. And I'm happy to take any questions from the committee.
Well, thank you, Ms. Anderson, and I was studying this bill. I think I'll go to Ms. Dalton. Wouldn't this put us out of compliance with the SSUTA? Because it just exempts certain ones.
Ms. Dalton. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we need to match the definition of durable medical equipment and the allowed carve-outs in SSUTA to be in compliance. The allowed carve-outs are by requiring a prescription based on Medicare or Medicaid payment or reimbursement or for home use. Right now, we are using all three of those carve-outs. At this point, if you wanted to expand it further, you would just need to provide a blanket exemption for all durable medical equipment.
Do we have any idea what that does to cost, or what? I guess we will have to work on that a little bit. So, Representative Loeffler. Excuse me, Representative Loeffler. Having a quorum, I'll officially call the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Schultz moves the minutes of March 7th, 20, and 17. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Loeffler, to House File 1631. We're going to take 1631 all the way through, and then I'm going to go back to the ones we've already heard and move those. So, Representative
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was going to be on why would we limit it to people who are covered by health insurance, because we have about 4 to 5%, and unfortunately probably we're growing again, of people who are uninsured, and they are the most disadvantaged, even though their health may be totally dependent upon being able to get this equipment and supplies. And so it seems like we might be more in compliance with the streamlined sales tax and be more fair to everyone who's dependent upon these health care supplies if we were to broaden it. And perhaps our witness would want to comment on that, but I do think we should look at a bigger picture if we can.
Ms. Anderson?
Certainly. Thank you for that question, Representative Loeffler. I don't believe that our industry would have any objection to covering these, regardless of the payer. We did propose this legislation as it has been proposed in the past on the entity-based exemption, because the technicality of billing a claim makes that collection of sales tax impossible for a provider. despite the unfairness in having someone who's purchasing these same items for cash pay sales tax and somebody under insurance not pay sales tax, as a business, we have the capacity to collect sales tax at a point of sale transaction. We don't have that capacity to under insurance reimbursement. But I can tell you, I think, from an industry standpoint, my colleagues in the audience are nodding their heads, we would have no objection expanding this to a product-based exemption versus an entity-based exemption.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful if we could ask the Department of Revenue to look into what that might mean.
I think Representative Quam is getting the message that we need a few more, a little more work on this. Ms. Anderson?
Certainly. I can provide a little context to that. The entity and product-based exemptions that we have in place do exempt these products for home use, so there is an exemption under the current law for that. It does exempt the majority of these products when they are covered by public programs, and a lot of these are used by more complex healthcare cases, so a lot of times it is public programs that are coming into play. So there really is, I would venture, a low number of cash sale items for this. Between the entity and the product-based exemptions that we already have in statute, what we're really talking about are complex wound care items that are not otherwise classified under the SSUTA. They're not either a prosthetic, a mobility-enhancing piece of equipment, or a durable medical piece of equipment. Things that would be used in treating complex surgical wounds, burn treatments, other types of more complex dressings. So it's not a real high utilization. Band-aids, nasal strips, those kinds of things worn on the body are already exempt. The more commonly consumed cash retail items are already exempt. These are much more complex items we're talking about.
I'm glad I caught that. Questions for members? Okay, with that, we will lay over House File 1631 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And if you could work this out a little more so when we start marking up the bill, we would have it the way it needs to be.
Certainly.
Okay, let's go back to the Quam bill since we have Representative Quam here. I will move House File 54. I will move the H0054A1 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Petersburg. Okay, item next. Now we have House File 54 as amended. I don't believe there was anyone we asked before. There's nobody who wanted to testify on behalf of or concerns thereof or the department. Then I will move that we lay House File 54 as amended over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Quam. We will now go to, I will move House File 115. We've had the discussion on that. Any other questions from members on 115? That's the Neuberger bill we just heard. I will move that House File 115 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Okay, so item next, House File 1869. I will move House File, that's the Jessup bill, Representative Jessup. I will move House File 1869. I don't see any amendments. And I do have listed a testifier just to see where we're at here. Is there anyone wish to testify on the bill? I do have a Paul Cervenek who is here. Anyone else wish to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns? The department, and I don't see the department here, and that's fine, but if they do have comments on some of these bills, we will accommodate them at a future time to make comments on these bills. And I see that someone got the memo, which is a good thing. And as we say, too much of a good thing is a good thing.
Mr. Chair.
We usually start here with the... I've totally lost control here, as if I ever had it. You can't lose something you never had. Thank you, Representative Perkins. Thank you. Oh, sweet Martha.
Oh. One bucket's for you and the rest is for us.
And I think maybe we can go in the audience some here, too, with...
Thank you.
Oh, no? No. He's bad. Okay. With that, Representative Jessup, I will move House File 1869 to your bill, sir.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. It is an honor to be before this committee, and I bring to you today some Sweet Martha's cookies.
Thank you.
Sweet Martha and her husband are actually customers of mine, and as you can see, I am a customer of hers as well. I do have enough for those in the audience. That's typically my style, so by all means, those that are in the audience, you get one too. With that, Mr. Chair, this bill is a bill as a tax incentive for families saving for their children's educations. As many of you know, all of the states across the country have a Section 529 college savings plan in place, and many states all across the country offer a tax incentive for parents to be saving for their children's education. Now, Section 529 College Savings Plan operates similar to an IRA in that parents go ahead and they make an investment into a savings account for their children, and then the earnings as they accumulate over the years of the child's time at home go ahead and are not taxed. So that at the opportunity when the child decides to attend post-secondary education, college, or university, those funds can be tapped to pay for the expenses of that education. Last week, U.S. News and World Report came out and they ranked the states all across the country. Minnesota came out very well. We came out overall number 3. However, there was one score where we did not do so well, and that was the debt that our post-secondary graduates come out with. We ranked 45th. What we want to do is the overall objective is really to reduce the amount of debt for those graduates as they graduate from post-secondary education. This bill is one particular vehicle to help with that situation. And what it does is it allows families to take either a tax deduction or receive a tax credit, depending on their own income situation. And the first scenario is a tax deduction. And that would be once you establish your taxable income, you could take a deduction. If you're a family with both, two spouses, you could take a maximum deduction of $3,000. The other alternative is you could take a tax credit. Let's assume that you would determine your tax bill. We'll just say, hypothetically, it's $1,000. You would have the opportunity, depending upon your income, to take a tax credit up to $500. So you could reduce the amount of tax that you would owe the state. So it's an either-or proposition. You can choose either an income deduction or you can choose a tax credit. Depends upon your income situation. For those that are of average to lower income means, the tax credit would be the benefit for them. For those that are average to a little bit higher than average income, then that would be an income deduction is how that would apply for them. So that's the essence of this bill. What we're trying to do is we are trying to help families in Minnesota to save more for their children's education, and in so doing, help to reduce the debt that our graduates here in the state come away with.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. I've got a couple questions here for Mr. Michael. Currently in Minnesota, you can do a Minnesota 529, but it's not a deduction, but it kind of works like a Roth where you put money that's been taxed in and the gains are not taxable if they're used. Or Mr. Williams, maybe?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So, Mr. Chair, under current law, you can make a contribution. You still pay taxes on the contribution amount, but you don't pay taxes on the investment income.
Okay, so it's kind of like a Roth, Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so what this bill would do is it would give a deduction or credit depending on the person's income. So then, since they got the deduction, when they take the money out, is that also tax-free, Mr. Williams? Not just the gain, but the principal?
Mr. Chair, if the contribution is withdrawn for a qualifying higher education expense, then yes.
Wow. Now, does this, Mr. Williams, does this include plans other than just Minnesota's? To any states?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, let's hear from the witness, then we'll go to member questions. And again, are there any other witnesses on behalf of or with concerns or the department? Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Sirkbenek. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Private College Council is an association of the private nonprofit colleges in Minnesota.
To the bell.
Mr. Chair, I want to start by thanking Representative Jessup for authoring this bill and Representative Wills and you who have supported this bill and authored these bills in prior years. We've been working for several years to establish this tax benefit for saving for college here in Minnesota. As Representative Jessup said, our colleges support this bill because it will be an incentive for families to save for college, and it will encourage college savings that way. The great benefit of savings for college is that it reduces the amount of parent and student borrowing that will be needed to pay for college. Put another way, the consequence of not saving for college is increased borrowing and increased student debt. In your packet, I provided a couple of charts that give you a little information about savings generally in our country. Savings has declined dramatically in the last 30 years. And I provided some information from an annual report done by Sallie Mae about how families pay for college. Savings is just a very modest, almost minimal amount of the way families pay for college when it's time to pay for college. This year, Sallie Mae reported that savings from all sources constituted only 11% of the total share of how a family pays for college, and savings in 529 plans constituted only 6% of how families pay for the cost of attendance. Minnesota is an outlier when it comes to the state tax treatment of 529 plan contributions. Of the states that have an income tax, most, a significant majority, provide a tax benefit for contributions to 529 plans. This bill will put us with the majority of states. And then finally, I just want you to know that studies show that even a small amount of college savings increases the likelihood of college enrollment and college completion. And those studies show that's true across the income spectrum and across spectrums of academic preparation. So this bill will not only help families pay for college, but it will build a college-going expectation in families at a young age. So students are going to be more likely to actually enroll and complete college as a result of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Sirkbenek. I do believe that this was in the conference report for House Bill 48, this particular bill. Okay. So that, Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the author. Up until the mid-2000s, for a few number of years, Minnesota actually had a matching program for low-income families who contributed to 529 plans, arguably more valuable than a tax credit to a low-income family because it was a, up to certain limits, a dollar-for-dollar match, a direct incentive. The tax deduction you offer, we know from previous testimony in this committee that 60% of the tax deductions in the state are claimed by the top 10% of households in terms of income, not folks we probably need to incent to do college savings. They're probably doing it already. And the tax credit is great, but only once you pay the taxes, which is a long ways from when you contribute the money to the 529 plan. Why not go back to Minnesota's matching program as an incentive for lower-income families to establish and maintain these products?
Representative Jessup?
Representative Daphne, I'm not aware of that program. It sounds like you are. Perhaps that may be a separate opportunity to pursue. This particular opportunity is similar to others that are set up in other states. And in terms of a tax credit, you know, a deduction right off of your taxes really is designed for those that are in a lower or average income position. And so that tax credit is only available if your family income is $80,000 or less. So it would not apply if you have someone that is, let's say, of more established means, per se. That tax credit would not be available for them.
And I think, Chair Dabney, what you're referring to is that was repealed in 2011, I believe.
Was it?
The program you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, was that recently? I thought it was earlier than that.
Mr. Williams, when was that?
He's nodding his head.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The program was repealed in 2011.
When did that start?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that immediately available.
Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Michael knows.
Mr. Michael, when did that start?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was in 1996 or 1995. It was a Representative Betterman, if you remember her, proposal, and a governor's initiative by Governor Carlson.
Thank you. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would suggest it would be worth exploring. I also would commend, if you're not yet receiving Governing Magazine, it goes to all of us. It's a very good magazine. They've got a story this month on the failure of 529 plans to incent people to save for college. And I haven't had a chance to read it, but as the committee considers this proposal and as the author considers this proposal, I found Governing to be a very credible source of information. It might be interesting to review that article. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Questions from members? Lead Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. So, well, Representative Jessup, you're getting, right to the point of where we need to go, on the affordability. And I, when you look at this program, and I think it has a lot of good merits, and I have to say, I read that article in Governing Magazine, and they looked at these plans. Now, not all of them. Some of them were back to what you were describing, Representative Dabney, on where they contribute. Like some of them provided in Cayuga County in Cleveland, in St. Louis, and Nevada, where they'd actually give some seed money. Once you hit kindergarten or something, the state or the county would literally put in $100 or whatever, an account, kind of a bank account. And what they found out is that the participation rate was very, very low, even when you basically set it up this way. And kind of the study, and this was done in 2013 through the Board of Governors, Federal Reserve, said that the participation rate, now I don't know if this was for tax deductions and credits or just for kind of these other type of college savings accounts, were like only about 2.5%. And in the lowest 50% income, it was less than 1%. Because they were saying those that tend to go into those programs tend to be wealthier, actually college-educated parents themselves who are more likely to have their kids go off to college anyway. As mentioned in the testimony, though, is what they said is that just by having the accounts, just a little bit, even in some cases with only a couple hundred dollars, it did incentivize the students to go into college. So that was a positive. And they also said it helped lower-income people set up checking and savings accounts where they might not have otherwise. So they said even besides kind of getting the savings in that, it actually was good in those regards. So I'm just thinking before we go ahead, and like I said, Representative Jessup, I think you're on and looking at things. Can those dollars, I think it's about $30 million over 2 years, I think, is what this would cost. Even would it be better to put $30 million into a college grant program or something? I think it is worthy of us to take a good look at, is this getting to where we want to go? Because there was a really good article in Governing Magazine, and they said it's popular, but it hasn't been hitting the mark necessarily. So I'm just wondering if we're going to be spending $30 million, if there's... And maybe, now I saw in Minnesota there's like 19,000 that take this, that participate in the 529 savings plan. I don't know what percent that is. I would think that maybe be higher than 2 or 2.5% that they showed in that study. So it might be better in Minnesota. But I just think this is worthy of discussion to kind of look at all sorts of different avenues on this to make sure that when we spend these dollars, it's really doing what we want to do. But thank you, Representative Jessup, for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Lee Marquardt. Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Marquardt, I think you hit on a key component. Minnesota is different than the rest of the nation. And I think, Representative Jessup, I just want to thank you for bringing this forward because in my district, my people that I represent are always looking about how can we save for college. They have usually both the household, both the breadwinners in the household are college educated, and they anticipate their children going to college. So this, they see these tools as really key. And I, you know, I touted Representative Wills when she carried similar language to this in the last biennium. They saw that as a great tool for them in saving for their child's education. And I did read the article, Representative Davion, on that. But I do think that Minnesota is different. I think that we are a state that value our higher education, and we're lucky for that because we see the results in the innovations that are created here in Minnesota. I just want to thank you for putting this bill forward. And I just signed on to it, too. So thank you.
Mr. Cervenek, have you read the governing article?
I have not, Mr. Chair.
I would suggest reading it. Do you have any comments on Lead Marquardt's or Chair Dabney's thoughts, or...
Mr.
I guess
Chair,
you probably should read the article first.
I will read the article. I would say I think that the question is, what will incent people to save? The advantage of having this in the tax form is every year there's a reminder for everybody that this is something to think about and do. A grant program requires an administrative procedure and a separate thing, and so I think that with that there's a challenge to how do we make sure everybody knows about it, how do we make it easy for everybody to do. The state grant program is easy because it's managed through the colleges. Now we're talking about how do we get people before college to save. I don't know what the ideal incentive is. I think that's really the question we have to keep trying to figure out. The best incentive is going to do the most good.
Chair Dabney and then Carlson. Chair Dabney.
Just briefly, and thank you for that. And absolutely, incentives are good, but Representative Anderson just indicated her constituents don't need an incentive. They're already doing this. So providing them with an incentive when you don't need one, you don't need to call me late for dinner. You don't need to call me twice for dinner. Once is enough. I'll be there. I think it would be interesting, since it is the Minnesota 529 plan, to ask TIAA, What do they know about the income demographics of folks who have 529 plans already? Is that matching who we need to incent to go on to higher education and complete? Because while we often focus in on the achievement gap in the K-12 system, we've got a significant gap in individuals accessing and then completing the higher education system, and I would suggest we target our efforts towards that gap rather than providing bonuses for people who've already identified they don't need a bonus. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Chair Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, knows, I've lost track, but years ago when I chaired Ed Finance, I carried some legislation that we actually put into law, and we called them gopher bonds. And they were tax-exempt bonds to encourage savings. And the idea was that those would be bonds in smaller denominations, so the average citizen could purchase them on a monthly basis or an annual basis, but they didn't have to invest. Those bonds go out usually at, what, $10,000? If you're going to buy one of those bonds, and so we put them in lower denominations. And it wasn't as successful as I had hoped at the time, Mr. Chairman, but then I also felt that it wasn't really promoted as strongly as it could have been. And at the time I was doing that, I got a fair amount of resistance from the private college council because they preferred that we focus on the financial aid program and not go in that direction. And in the end, they, I think, finally kind of agreed that they didn't see it as a threat to the financial aid program, and that was not my intent. But part of the argument, at least early on when I introduced it, was that they preferred to put their efforts in, let me put it that way, into the financial aid program rather than what I had coined or one of the staff suggested, gopher bonds, which had nothing to do with the University of Minnesota, a lot to do with the state of Minnesota and the gophers. But I don't even know if that program exists now, Mr. Chairman. It's been so many years since I carried that and chaired that particular committee, but maybe somebody there knows if that's still available. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it was able, Grandma, Grandpa, you know, could all buy these bonds.
Chair Carlson, I believe we have some that would probably know that. Mr. Michael? Do we still have the statute still there, but it's not really active?
No.
The statute has never been repealed then. It's what Mr. Chairman, what Mr. Michael is saying.
Okay.
Something that could be promoted, perhaps, if people were to look into it again, then being that the law is already there.
Okay. Other questions for members? And to the department, Mr. Cummins, we're on House File 1869 right now. Do you have any comments on that?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I was in Grove City last night and Atwater. And in Grove City, when you go through there on Highway 12 to the right, was that your dad's church, the big Lutheran church?
It was, yeah.
Very nice church.
Very nice church.
Yes. Okay. So with that, I will move the House File 1869. I'll be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Representative Jessup, thank you for the treats and snacks.
Thank you.
Okay, item next, the last bill that we have is House File 315. Chair Anderson S. will move House File 315. I do not see any amendments at this time. I have several testifiers. I have Brad, Bernie, Barty, Todd, Lisa. Is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns thereof? Can you please state your name?
My name is Tony Larson. I called yesterday to touch the office.
What did you call me? Oh. In the list. Yes, I'm on a lot of people's lists. Okay. With that being said, we will put you on. So we'll start with Brad, Bernie, and then Barty, Todd, and then Ms. Larson. To your bill, Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill provides a tax credit to employers that to incentivize them to provide a parental leave benefit to their employees. And then it also provides a tax credit to employees who work for an employer that doesn't offer that benefit so that they can offset the cost of taking leave when they have a child. And that's what the bill does, Mr. Chair. And I know that we've got some testifiers that want to come, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. So.
Okay. Well, you can certainly have all the time you need, but so we will go to testimony now. Mr. Lato from the AFL-CIO, could you please join us, sir? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Leto, Letso Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. We appreciate Representative Anderson's and other legislators' awareness that a growing number of working families are struggling to make ends meet on their basic necessities, let alone to be able to afford time off of work to bond with a new child. Unfortunately, we don't believe 315 does much to help working families able to afford the cost of taking time off of work to care for a new child. Despite the analysis of the Department of Revenue, which we don't quibble with, we do that because this hasn't been done in any other state. We believe very few workers have the ability to front money to take paid time off for the birth or adoption of the child, not to mention that the bill doesn't address caring for an ill family member. So what does a worker do when a family member falls ill or has a serious health condition? Tax credits for workers and employers will not replace the need for a robust paid family and medical leave insurance program funded by employers and employees. A proposal that passed the Senate in the 2016 tax bill after going through numerous committees. That bill did provide both parental and family leave. Such a proposal would provide real coverage for working families and help small businesses throughout the state to be able to afford coverage. Working Minnesotans can't wait until tax season to care for a new baby. Working families cannot afford to wait until they do their taxes to obtain credit. Again, while the Minnesota AFL-CIO does appreciate the legislature's growing recognition that at least paid parental leave is needed, we don't believe House File 315
does the best for working families. Please vote no on House Bill 315. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions for the witness from members? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now go to Bernie Hesse, UFCW 1189. And does the department wish to testify on this bill? Okay, so you will kind of wrap it up then. Okay. Please state your name and who represents the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm with the Food and Commercial Workers Union. We represent workers in retail, long-term care, and food processing. We have concerns, too, about House File 315, and we would urge legislators to seek other remedies. We really are in support of paid family leave. We would like to see an insurance program developed. We believe we don't need any more subsidies for big businesses. Perhaps we could figure out a better formula. A fraction of wage replacement in this bill, I think, will lead to little utilization by workers who need it the most, and those are service sector workers. A tax credit, we don't think, is really going to drive big policy changes. So it's another concern we have. All workers, doesn't matter what you do for a living, you need time to care, and you need the financial means to do it if you're caring for a child. As one worker put it, workers shouldn't have to choose between care for a baby or to make rent. Applying for a tax credit is a lot like shopping at Menards sometimes. You know, when you get done, you get the receipt, walk over and get the rebate form, and then you got to wait for the credit or the check. We would like to see a program that provides support, not a delayed payment, and we also need a larger replacement on the wages. So we're glad that this discussion's been brought up, but we don't think this bill is ready or provides the benefit that would really help out a lot of workers. Thank you, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. If it was this bill or nothing, would you support this bill?
No, we would not support it.
Chair Deskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hesse, and even the last testifier, I'm curious, you know, before session started, the governor put through in a temporary way, and many of us will say that he did it without authorization and law to do it, paid family leave benefits. I am hearing, Mr. Hesse, from people that are saying that, well, I'm working with this guy, and he takes paid family leave and tells me that during that time he's on paid family leave, he's hired to work another job. How would you address that?
Mr. Hesse?
Okay. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we support programs that help families survive or make it when they're out. In this bill, we're taking care of a newborn. We would like to see something where if you miss work, you're not in financial peril. Should somebody be working another gig while they're receiving this benefit? Of course not.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Hesse, I agree with you. The thing is, we're hearing it's happening already under this temporary paid family leave that the governor found a way to enact in the interim. And if the intent is to provide for the ability for both parents to bond with their kids, and they're not, it's obviously not working. So I like Representative Anderson's approach here. It encourages a culture in which the employer and the employee work out something rather than a forced mandate like we have here now that seems to be being abused and seems to not follow in the spirit of what it is intendedly marketed to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hesse. And there's some conversations that are taking place behind the scenes. I think now is an appropriate time to kind of bring into the public, and that is that I have this little bill called Uniform Labor Standards that perhaps you're familiar with, and one of the discussions points around that is if and what a parental leave program could be and could look like. And there's basically two different sides on the progressive side that are arguing right now. One side is arguing that any changes or accommodations should be made to help everybody. That it should be, to paraphrase their terms, that it should be a benefit that's universal and accesses to everyone. Another side that's coming from the left are those that are from more of the union side, people who belong to memberships who say that their pay, people who work for the unions, that they're paid for by union dues paying members, and it's not their job to advocate for non-members. And that if people want better benefits, higher pay, better working conditions, rather than coming to the legislature and changing the law to implement a benefit set, those people should join a union. And I think one of the arguments I've heard from the union side of things is that when those people, people who want union benefits without paying for them, are called freeloaders. So talk to me. If the goal is to expand worker benefits, compensation, and pay, I've heard over and over again unions say that, then why wouldn't you simply advocate for people to join members as opposed to changing the law and taking away the benefits that you're working for your members to get and giving them for free to non-union members?
Mr. Hesse, are you aware of the bill that Representative Graffalo refers to?
Vaguely, Mr. Chair. I'm calling it.
Okay, Mr. Hesse.
We believe that when you raise working conditions for all, we all benefit. We do organize workers. We would like to see more people join unions, but we also look at this sometimes as a, I'll put it down with capitalism, for example. We represent workers at Cub Foods. Across the parking lot is a Walmart. I would actually like to see Walmart workers be paid more, so when I bargain a contract with Cub or Super Value, we don't get slapped in the face all the time about the $4 or $5 an hour wage difference. So we believe by lifting up everybody, we'll all benefit, and it's, I don't know, just a principle of solidarity.
Chair Graffel.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hesse, if that's the case, then what are your members paying for?
Well, I get that question, Mr. Chair, Representative, I get that question a lot. I think a lot of it, and when members pay fees to a union, it's for activity as we build our health and welfare funds. It's legislative initiatives. It's job training. There's a number of things that are involved in that.
So, Mr. Graffel?
Mr. Just kind of getting back to the bill at hand, I want to thank Representative Anderson for bringing this bill forward. I think there's many conversations that are taking place, and I think her bill is a step in the right direction, and it's one that we can work on again. If the goal is that we want to expand benefit sets, remove barriers and obstacles for employers to offer additional benefit sets, if the stated goal is the real goal, then the Anderson bill accomplishes that, and I think it merits serious consideration by the committee. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testifier, and thank you for Ms. Representative Anderson for bringing this forward. You know, as I look at, you know, where the growth of the economy and stuff has gone over the years, we can go back to after World War II and the big increase in productivity and the economy and how that grew. It had to do with people's productivity and increasing what they produced over the period of time, and the wages grew accordingly. Now we're getting to have more and more bills brought forward or legislation or ordinances and everything to try to help us become actually less productive and yet still get paid for it. And that's a juggling act that I think we all have to work with. These are called benefits for a reason. They're not addressed as pay because in reality, whoever you're working for that you said that you would agree to do a certain job for a certain amount of pay, you're actually asking them now to pay you not to come into work for those. And I want that benefit too, so I'm not begrudging anybody to do that, but to have the government and others to deal with actually the intervention in public relations, in employment relations, and saying, hey, now not only are we going to be taking more business taxes from you, but we're also going to force you to pay people not to work for your business, where they only generate the revenues to pay workers with productivity, with what's there. And so I'm just trying to struggle and figure out where do we come with that balance in which we allow members who are employees and the employers to come together and determine what benefits best fits them without trying to have a one-size-fits-all. And it seems to me that Representative Anderson's bill at least gives an opportunity to start working on that. Whether it's the right decision or not, we don't know. But it seems to me that we want to help people ability to be able to meet with their children and do the things they want. And really the only thing that we have as a government entity is the taxes that we hold and can give back. And so on the one hand, we're just dealing with the dollars that we have available. What you're asking for is actually intervention into employee relations. And I'm concerned about where do we stop? Do we then just all become a socialistic type state and have everything controlled by the government? That hasn't worked in all of history at this point. And so I'm just not sure where you would like us to go at this point, if you could kind of give us some idea.
Mr. Hesse?
There are many, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there are many things that we need to have rules. We also need to have programs that lift people up. I would like to see this as a government insurance program. And, yes, there is a, between workers and management, there are benefits that are exchanged in, for work. But to say that that you're paying people for not working, there's a benefit in having a healthy workforce. There's a benefit in reducing stress. There's a benefit in having families that are whole at a workplace. So that's my response.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you. And we're, I think that's an agreement there. But is it government's job to make the determination for business what value that is, or should that be dependent upon the business that is paying the funds? Because, and again, in reality, they're not getting the amount of productivity that they need. I mean, if just for an example, what if everybody happened to have a sick child on a particular day? Is the business supposed to close, or where are the options that are available to them? So I think it's just something that we need to continually work on and struggle with, and I would certainly highly recommend you that if it's all or nothing and you choose nothing, you're kind of also making a stance that it's not about making gradual improvements, that you really do want all or nothing. So thank you.
Okay, that will wrap up with Mr. Hesse here with the Rosa Mezza. Or do you want to go through all the way?
I'll end up the whole thing.
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay, Barty Wahi? Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and provide your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Barty Wahi, and I'm the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. We pay particular attention to the needs of children who face a steeper ladder to success, including children living in families who can't afford to meet basic needs, children of color, and American Indian children. We believe it is important to ensure families have access to paid parental leave. When new parents have access to paid parental leave, research shows it improves maternal health, child health, and increases a father's involvement in his child's life. Every 10 weeks of paid parental leave also decreases infant mortality by 10%. Despite the fact that Minnesota children have parents in the workforce, paid parental leave remains a luxury for many. Among women, 1 in 4 returns to work within 2 weeks of having a baby. Those who are able to take longer leaves tend to be higher income earners, and those with shorter leave tend to be lower income earners. We believe House File 315 falls short. The goal of the proposal before you should be to expand access to paid parental leave to those who are least likely to have it, including low-income workers who tend to be women and people of color. This proposal does not meet that goal. With regard to the employer tax credit in this bill, according to the American Enterprise Institute, similar tax credits for employers have proven to be ineffective at changing employer behavior. Therefore, we cannot expect that an employer tax credit in this bill would expand access to paid leave. With regard to employee tax credits in this bill, the employee tax credit for unpaid parental leave in this legislation would be unworkable for those eligible for it. Half of Americans report that they would not be able to afford a $400 emergency expense, Low and mid-income families cannot afford to go without any income for weeks while on leave, only to receive 25% of it back months later. This proposal would not achieve the goal of expanding access to paid parental leave, and yet would come at a cost to the state. We believe that the Paid Family Medical Leave Act is a bill that might help provide better access for all families in Minnesota. Minnesotans deserve a solution that will work. That's why, instead of tax credits, we support a comprehensive paid family and medical leave insurance program, like those that have been time-tested and proven effective in multiple U.S. states and around the world, and have garnered bipartisan support among the public, and like the one included in Representative Metz's Paid Family Medical Leave Act, which is House File 1013. We appreciate that there is a growing recognition that our current voluntary paid family system, family medical leave system, is failing many children and parents, and we appreciate the conversation that is happening, not just here but in other spaces. We believe we must be thoughtful in addressing the major challenges and implement a comprehensive solution that's going to achieve its intended goals. We believe tax credits are not the answer and hope you will expand your conversation on this important topic to include paid family medical leave insurance. Thank you. I'm here for questions.
Thank you. And to the question I asked the last gentleman, if it was this bill or nothing, what would you do?
I think that we would say nothing. I think it is a challenge for low-income and mid-income families to front-end a family leave. We also believe that it should be paid family medical leave because we know that folks need time off, not only to welcome someone into their family, but when they have to let one go.
Okay, thank you. Questions for the witness? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
The next gentleman here, Todd Mickelson. Is Mr. Mickelson here? Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. And then, members, be my intention to then go to Holly Larson and then the department, then some questions. And then just a little bit about tomorrow. We have floor session at 10, so I'll announce on the floor, so many minutes after adjournment or something like that, just so you're aware of that. So we'll be starting a little bit later tomorrow. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is Todd Mickelson, and I own a small business in Orono, Minnesota called SprayRack.com. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, and members.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Although I appreciate the recognition of and the need for parental leave compensation, paid family leave policy does poll very high among small business owners. But this bill only provides a fraction of what is needed, and it's at a higher cost. It would also be a burden to the taxpayers of Minnesota, and it would add to the paperwork of my small business. It would not provide any compensation until the next tax period, possibly months later. Almost all workers virtually can't float that kind of money for that long, nor can most small businesses. Our main employee who runs our assembly shop just had 5 weeks off for a hip replacement. We pay them because that's how employees should be treated. In fact, his wife and he wrote us a really nice note thanking us for that because they would have had to dip into their savings otherwise. But it cost us a couple thousand dollars to do that. This program would have not helped us with that situation whatsoever. It would have only helped had he had a baby, and even then, it would not have helped enough. Not only does this bill not provide for enough time for the mother to stay home with the baby, it also doesn't provide any time or help for an illness of that person, a family member's illness, including this newborn baby. It also would not provide coverage for somebody staying home to take care of a dying mother or a dying father or spouse or a dying child. Of course, it would also not have helped us in our situation with our employee and his hip. I can tell you that my business would not go through the hassle to even apply for the help this bill would offer. If we did end up qualifying, it would just add to our already complex administrative paperwork. It would not provide enough for our employee, and it would also be a burden to taxpayers of Minnesota. I am familiar with another bill, HF 1013, the Paid Family and Medical Leave Bill, and it's authored by Representative Metza. That bill, if it was in place, would have helped us with our issue with our employee. It would have cost us less to provide more. It would not have added to our paperwork, and it would have paid for itself instead of adding more burden to the taxpayer. And it's a virtual replica of the plan that folds so high with small business owners that I mentioned, and I have details about that survey. So I urge you to vote no on the passage of this bill. It just doesn't provide enough, and it's a higher cost for all. I hope this legislature begins discussion on the paid family and medical leave bill in a hearing sometime soon, and to address some of the things that have been said. We didn't, I heard it mentioned that we're incentivizing people to not work. We didn't pay our employee when he had his hip replacement to incentivize him to not work. We paid him because he had to have his hip replaced and he couldn't work. Small business owners choose their employees very carefully, and their employees choose their small business owner very carefully. The kind of relationships that go on in truly small businesses are the kind of relationships where we can't afford to lose our employees. It costs us way more to train in a new employee than it would to pay him the money that we paid him already for his time off. So it's a bit of an insult to say that people are going to jump all over taking advantage of something like this by taking advantage of their boss and not working and getting paid. That doesn't happen in the small business world.
I don't think that was an insult whatsoever. It was a situation that is happening, and it was addressed. It was not an insult.
Okay.
Well done.
Yes, I'm finished. And I'll take questions if you'd like.
Thank you.
I do have some copies of the...
And we'll pass those out. Let's pass those out. Get a page. Thank you. Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, in the designing of a possible paid leave program, is it your preference that your business would have a mandatory benefit that would have to be offered, or that would be voluntary?
Mr. Mickelson.
I would vote for mandatory so that we have a realistic pool that can be paid for. Paying the amount of a small cup of coffee once per week doesn't set me back as far as this couple thousand dollars set me back to pay my employee when he had his hip replaced. So, and if I'm the only one paying it, well, of course, there's not enough money. So I vote for mandatory for all businesses to have that.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, for those businesses that are already offering a benefit set that are above this, would you say that should be mandatory for them as well?
Mr. Mickelson?
If they're already offering something, then I think it can be talked about at what level. Maybe then they're exempt from this. But I know most small businesses would take advantage of it, even because it would cost them less than a lot of the businesses who currently do provide this. HF 1013 would cost them less. So I think a lot of businesses would choose it. But yes, I think it could be talked about that if they provide for something already, they can be exempt.
Chair Garofalo.
Chairman, and to the testifier, for those employers right now that are offering that benefit, assuming they're offering the benefit now, they would have a new payroll tax. So not only would they be offering the benefit, they would also be paying a payroll tax. How would that save them money?
Mr. Mickelson?
Representative Garofalo, what I'm saying is that if they can be exempt from the mandatory payroll tax, if they choose to do their own program.
Chair Garofalo.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, so just to be clear, the testifier is saying if you don't offer the benefit, then it would be mandatory, but if you already have your own sick leave program, you can keep it and it wouldn't be mandatory. Am I stating your position correctly?
Mr. Mickelson?
I believe there can be something worked out to find a level where that kicks in. And just to add my comment, I do believe that a lot of businesses that currently offer it would prefer to pay $1.50 per employee a week into the mandatory system instead of the system that they're currently doing.
Chair Garofalo.
So, Mr. Chairman, the testifier, for those, do you think that it would be better for employees if employers got rid of the program and just went to this program, the Mezzo bill?
Mr. Mickelson.
Representative Garofalo, it totally depends on the system that they're offering. If they've designed their own system, it may or may not be better or worse for the employee.
Chair Garofalo?
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm hearing from the testifier is that the employer, rather than paying twice, would have a choice of downscaling their benefits to the state. I just
I haven't heard anyone advocate that position yet, but I can let it go. My final question would be, you were very clear in stating that to the testifier that for businesses it should be mandatory. Do you believe that mandate should apply to government as well?
Mr. Mickelson?
Senator, Representative Garofalo, I don't know enough about it to really give you a clear answer. Like I said, I'm a small business owner. I'm not.
So, Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, if this benefit is so important that we require it for private sector employers, why would we not require it for government?
Mr. Mickelson?
Representative Garofalo, I didn't say that. I just said that I don't really have a clear answer. I haven't studied it, and I don't have my opinion on that particular answer to that particular question.
Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, you were very clear in your answer about the mandate on businesses. You did not equivocate at all. You said yes. So I'm wondering, besides the fact that you haven't studied government, what is different between the employer-employee relationship in the private sector and the public sector?
Mr. Mickelson?
Representative Garofalo, like I said, what I know is being a small business owner. So yes. I'm just saying I can't offer you an opinion as an answer to your question.
Chair Garofalo?
I think that's a fair statement. Thanks.
We will wrap this up. Well, okay, Representative Hertaus and then Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mickelson, you mentioned a cup of coffee a week, and then a little bit later you mentioned a buck and a half a week. So if I extrapolate that out times 52 weeks, that's $78 of contribution. How does this really fund itself?
Mr. Mickelson?
Representative Hertaus, it funds itself because many, many $1.50s per week are going into a pool, and not as many $1.50s per week are pulling out of the pool.
Representative Hertaus?
Well, Mr. Mickelson, I mean, really, $78 isn't even a day's wages. One simple claim would quickly eat into the fund. I mean, have you really done any comprehensive study on the cost of this program?
Mr. Mickelson?
Representative Hertaus, there has been a lot of study done on this program. I didn't do it personally, so I don't know as many details as some people who have studied it. I believe there are people in the audience here who have studied it who can answer your question.
Representative Hertaus?
I yield.
Okay, Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mickelson, I don't know exactly what you had meant about your comments about the example I brought up, but I had a state employee tell me that a state employee that they worked with decided to exercise the paid family leave that Governor Dayton instituted without authority in law to do so, and that other employee went and during the time when they were supposed to be bonding with their kids, as you and others have used to advocate your position, instead of doing that, they went and worked another job during the entire time period. So did you question whether that was a true account or that it didn't happen, or what did you have to say? Recount, if you will, what you said.
Mr. Mickelson?
Representative Drazkowski, I realize there's going to be some abuse by some people. You mentioned that person is a state worker. A lot of people don't like their jobs. A lot of people try and get out of it. A lot of people try and take advantage. That doesn't happen in the small business world. I'm a small business, very small business owner. And in all small business owners that I know, we have good relationships with our employees because we can't afford not to. It costs us way more to replace an employee than it does to keep them. That's why I was willing to pay a couple thousand dollars to keep my employee on and cover his job for him while he was having his hip replaced. In truly small businesses, the type of thing that you're talking about happens extremely seldomly, if at all. I'm not questioning whether or not your story is true. I'm sure that's going to happen here and there. But it doesn't happen in my experience as a small business owner.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mickelson, I don't find a lot of credibility in what you have to offer today. I'm a small business owner. Many members around this table are small business owners, and we know a lot of constituents that are small business owners. I can't think of a small business owner that I know that would volunteer to have a mandate placed upon them and then have payroll deduction placed upon them to pay for that. I don't know anywhere else in the world, anybody else in the world that would offer that same testimony you did. But thank you for it anyway.
Could I respond?
Mr. Mickelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, this similar plans to 1013 are going on in other states, and they're being very successful in other states. Again, there are people in the audience who know more about this than I do, but there are a few other states that have this implemented, and it's going very well. And again, small businesses, the survey that I passed out was 1,572 small businesses. Maybe we know completely different pools of small business owners. I would ask you, do you know, if you're a small business owner, do you have a lot of employees who would just take advantage of this?
And sir, you don't get to ask the questions. Representative Metsa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, that is the case, Representative Drazkowski. I think it's an oversight needs to get fixed in both Representative Anderson's bill today in lines 2.10 through 2.12. We have those protections in place to make sure people aren't working. And in House File 1013, which is the other bill we're technically talking about, which is my bill, we have those protections in lines 7.27 and 2.8. So that being said, I think the two bills we're discussing right now do have those protections, and the governor should address your concern.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Ms. Larson, Ms. Holly Larson. Then we'll go to the department, and then we'll wrap it up. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Holly Larson, and I'm here as a citizen. I live in Shoreview.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I and other women testified at the last committee about this bill, so today I'll just keep my short testimony focused on the tax issues related to this bill. Because my understanding of the tax committee's role is to evaluate proposed legislation for its cost to taxpayers, weighted by its effectiveness at the tax credit's goal. For this bill, you need to evaluate the taxpayer cost of funding this tax credit with how it will help new Minnesota parents stay home with their newborns. And my husband and I hope to have a child in the coming years, so as a Minnesotan who would be eligible for this tax credit, I want to make it clear to the committee. This tax credit would have no impact on how much time I could stay home to recover from birth or to take care of my newborn who isn't old enough to go to a licensed daycare facility or be able to roll over on her own to reduce suffocation risks. So that is how it would impact my family. And this is because a $250 a week tax credit that I would get a year later doesn't help me with my out-of-pocket costs for a birth that are over $2,000 and daycare costs that are $400 a week for an infant, all of which while I'm not receiving any income. And my husband and I are middle-class people, so if this doesn't work for us, I can say for pretty sure it won't help lower-income parents stay at home longer. At the last hearing, a member suggested, why doesn't the legislature just try this to see if it works, given the current crisis facing people like me in the state? And that would seem reasonable if there was no research on other cost-effective ways to help families. But in my limited research, I found no other state considering this type of unpaid leave tax credit. And that's not because we're exceptional here in Minnesota. It's because four other states have or are implementing actual paid family leave programs that give near immediate wage replacement for families. And the research supports these plans. And many other states are considering paid family leave bills right now. And this isn't a situation of perfect as the enemy of good. This is a situation of a costly, ineffective bill that won't allow more parents to stay home with their newborns and will cost taxpayers like me more money. In my mind, that fails the cost-effectiveness test that this committee is charged to evaluate. Instead, on behalf of my family and my friends' families, I ask you to give the actual paid family medical leave bill a hearing because that bill would help my family.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Larson. Questions? Okay, we'll go to the department. Thank you very much. And there was something missing in Grove City as I drove through last night.
Well,
this is a picture here, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, you did bring Grove City and Atwater into the record. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
From Grove City.
From Grove City, Mr. Chair. So you brought that into the record, and now, when I was in high school, and I maybe was a little bit of a punk, right,
For the record.
For the record, Mr. Chair, I would plaster the door of my favorite high school physics, chemistry, calculus teacher.
There's only one.
With DFL literature, right? Because, you know, I on the weekends I would sort of, you know, do whatever I did, you know. And then the next day, Mr. Chair, I would see plastered over all of that DFL literature a plastering of GOP, House candidate literature. Now, I think that there may have been somebody in the household that was giving a stack of literature and saying, before you come home, make sure you do a route. I don't know. But when I graduated, Mr. Chair, there was a big, I would say, couple-inch plastering of literature upon literature upon literature on my favorite physics teacher's door. That favorite physics teacher, he rolled up all of that literature, put a big bow on it, and handed it to me as a diploma. And it was pretty neat. We were having our graduation rehearsal, and he came in, and, you know, they were giving us these fake diplomas and whatever, and he said, well, here's a diploma for you. And so I kept that for until my last move, Mr. Chair. It was it was good memories from high school, and so...
You did get a real diploma, too, right?
Signed? Yes, from Atwater, Cosmos, Grove City. So
awesome. But what was missing in Grove City was I just figured at the entrance where the sign says Grove City that there'd be a statue of Mr. Paul Cummings.
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, but did you see the Grove Mill? That was that's you had to take a diversion off the road in order to go down to the city park.
No, I went straight through.
Okay. Next time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. What are we on here? Okay. So if you could address from the department's respective House File 315.
Mr. Chair, I reached out to Representative Anderson's office yesterday, and first I'm going to talk about the importance of paid family leave, Mr. Chair, and then I'll address some of the issues in the underlying bill.
Thank you.
So the Georgetown University Law Center and Berkeley Center on Health, Economic, and Family Security made some compelling points about changes to workplace over time. They wrote, over the past 40 years, powerful demographic and societal shifts have irrevocably changed the American workforce. Today, women make up nearly half of all U.S. workers. This change has had a dramatic effect on the way families manage their responsibilities at home and at work. Our population has aged significantly. Many older adults are working well past traditional age of retirement. Transformative civil rights laws empower people with disabilities, allowing them to be productive workers. But the way our workplaces are set up to get work done has failed to keep pace with those changes. The result is a profound mismatch between the needs of the modern workforce and the structure of the modern workplace. The University of Minnesota worked to provide information to the legislature on how to move forward paid family and medical leave in Minnesota. The report currently states that there are three states with some form of paid family and medical leave, and an additional two that provide paid medical leave only. Workers in the other 45 states rely on voluntary employer-based system benefit of paid family and medical leave, whose quality varies from one employer to another, if it is offered at all. Employers may elect to provide workers with paid leave for family or for medical reasons through benefits such as sick leave, vacation time, parental leave, or medical leave, or they may negotiate collective bargaining agreements with such plans. There's no legal right to do so. As a result, only 13% of workers nationally receive full pay while on FMLA qualifying leaves. While almost three-quarters of Minnesota workers receive at least some pay when they are out of work for family and medical reasons, access to pay during leave is unequally distributed. Currently, more than a quarter of all family and medical leaves in Minnesota are without any compensation during leave. However, low-wage, black, Hispanic, younger, part-time, or less educated workers are much more likely to manage leaves without any pay. According to various studies, paid family leave can lead to greater job security, is associated with lower infant mortality rates, and it lead to higher employment retention rate for, and higher incomes for families in the U.S. A study of the Institute for Women's Policy Research showed that of the 86 countries examined, 186 countries examined, 96 offered some pay to mothers during leave. The United States and Suriname, while they do not mandate unpaid parental leave, are the only other countries that do not require employers to provide paid time off for new parents. If the question is, how can we ensure the most amount of Minnesotans would have access to paid family leave, we believe that other proposals would have a larger effect for all Minnesotans everywhere in Minnesota. However, Mr. Chair, we do agree on the underlying problem. Mr. Chair, in the bill, the indexing on a county level would present significant challenges and may result in up to 87 different credit allocations calculations before taking into consideration the effects of a taxpayer moving from one county to another. As with any tax credit, the money from the credit would be received the year after the leave takes place, so the money would not be in the hands of the people during the leave. Finally, this would primarily impact those businesses already engaged in the activity rather than those businesses we hoped to adopt these policies. So we do have some concerns, Mr. Chair. We do appreciate the sort of trying to think of ways to come and solve a compelling problem in our society. And as this bill moves forward, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with you and Chair Anderson and members and staff, and we thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you.
Questions for the department, Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, I've seen some of that research before, and since you brought up research about family medical leave and so forth, do you also have a comparative in regards to cost of living and tax rates, et cetera, in those countries as well? And are we comparative in that regard as well, or are there some trade-offs that oftentimes happen in one versus the other? It's always, I think, a challenge to only use one statistic and not compare everything. So I was curious if you have any information about that.
Mr. Cummings? So, Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, the analysis that this particular study did analyzed 186 countries. So among those countries, there are countries that have higher tax rates, on whether it's income or property or sales, and much lower tax rates as well. So we see a wide variety of different policies. I know that there are other studies that talked about, we are maybe the only industrialized country that doesn't have paid medical leave, but, I didn't really know what that definition of what those countries were, so I didn't bring that into my testimony today. What you see is you see higher and lower tax rates among the countries that I referenced in my testimony.
Representative Petersburg?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Cummings as well. And I think along with that tax rate, there's often an idea about what costs for food and other things and what the actual cost of living is as well, and those all do play a factor in it. And I haven't seen those comparatives to really know whether or not family medical leave, whether it's paid or not paid, whether or not it impacts the overall society and economy in regards to that, because I'm concerned about not only employment and employee benefits, but also about the employer costs as well. And we oftentimes always only talk about, what the benefit is to the employee, but there's also concerns about the employer as well, which actually generates the funds for the employee. So they're all working together, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Okay, with that, Chair Anderson S., would you like to wrap it up?
I would, Mr. Chair. Members, we've had a lot of comments about this bill. And what you need to realize, first of all, is that we don't have anything in place. So for those individuals that are concerned about the wait, this actually provides relief upon June 30th of 2017 for individuals that are seeking to get this credit. In tax committee overall, we pass a lot of tax changes to influence the behavior of folks. And we've done that on many things, from tobacco to the working family credit to a whole host of different things. And this bill is following that tradition that tax policy does have an impact on the behavior of how we operate in our state. when you look at whether this has been done before, the United Kingdom has done this. They provide a tax credit to individuals, so this is not unique to Minnesota. But beyond that, I think that this is offering a carrot, an incentive, rather than a hammer for providing this tool for families. And that's the route that I think, as Representative Petersburg pointed out, it's creating that balance that we need here in the state, and I think it's the right approach to take. So with that, Mr. Chair, I just ask for your support.
Okay, so Chair Anderson, as for news, or motion that House File 315 be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax bill. Thank you, Chair Anderson. Thank you to the department and all those that testified. So with that, listen to the, on the floor tomorrow as to what time we'll be meeting in tax committee tomorrow morning. It's supposed to be a paper push in the morning, so we should be able to have most of the committee. So with that, thank you, members, for your work today. Good government all the time.